Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You are listening to Total EM. I have with me Tyler Cristofoli from the Lifestar podcast. He was nice enough to grace me with his presence. He is an awesome paramedic who has been doing a lot of stuff, and he's got this perfect podcast that's going on that if you're an EMS or even just interested in EMS, go to the Lifestar podcast and listen to him. But I don't want to take anything away from you. I want you to go ahead and just introduce yourself here for a moment, if you don't mind.
Yeah, my name is Tyler Cristofoli. I am a critical care ground transport paramedic out here in southeastern Wisconsin for a organization called Lifestar EMS. And I actually operate as the training coordinator for that company. And I'm the host of the Lifestar podcast.
And so you actually have quite a few different podcasts that you've done so far, and you've talked about hot topics such as airway management, ketamine most recently, but you actually proposed something that I thought would be a really neat idea to talk about. And we haven't got to talk about ventilator management much on Total EM. I've referred people to go to other podcasts such as MCRIT because there is a beautiful piece, Dominating the Vent. It's a two-part series. If you want to get the basics of how to manage a vent, that's a great place to get started. But you had something that you proposed, and it's a little more advanced, but it's something I think a lot of the listeners need to know, because as we were talking about earlier today, when we were kind of preparing for this episode, you asked me about if PAs and docs actually manage their own vents in the ED setting. And I said that it kind of depends on where you're at, but a lot of rule settings, it seems like we're doing it a lot more. RT will do it, but sometimes, as I've noticed, especially when you have, say, the crashing asthmatic patient, they're not very used to it, and they're going to try and refer to texts and try and figure out things. If you should know this already. You should be working off of this. If you're going to manage anyone critically ill, you need to know your stuff ahead of time. And so we talked a lot about that, and we talked about how, for example, I want to know exactly how that vent works, and I want to be able to control my settings. But you took it a step further. You actually brought in a little more complex of a case. Can you introduce it?
One of the patients that have been giving me chest pain for the last year is the patient that is the perfect storm of patient. And this is when you have a combination of underlying obstructive pathology, we'll say emphysema, for example, and now they have an acute infection. Maybe they got some infiltrates and they start to get that injurious lung pattern, decreased lung compliance, and now you're battling because you have to optimize that exhalation time, but you also have to make sure you allow enough inhalation and inspiratory support to oxygenate that patient. So you're really battling a fine line here. And so I wanted to look at this patient because honestly, I don't feel like there is enough lip service to this hybrid population or subset of patients. And it can be a real pain in the ass to manage. And so that's what I wanted to do, was start the dialogue for this. Not so much tell you what you should be doing, but this was a proposal. And I just want to plug that and preface that this is not a recommendation yet. This is me coming up with a couple ideas and things that have worked for me in the past, but I do not think it is anywhere near ready for prime time.
Now, there may be a few people out here, and I think it's very few at this point if they're listening to this podcast, because they'd be listening to a PA and they probably wouldn't like it anyway. But if you're out there wondering, why should a paramedic be the one who's bringing up this idea? And like I said, there's absolutely no offense to Tyler, because Tyler knows his shit. There's no debate about that. And if you don't believe that, go to the Lifestar podcast, listen to the one, which we'll include in the show notes anyway, but listen to all of his other stuff, and you'll realize he does know what he's talking about on this. Now, the reason why I bring this up is because I know some people are going to say, well, why isn't a physician doing this or something else? I mean, if you really feel that way about healthcare, it's kind of hard that you're listening to FOMED, because you should be listening to someone like a paramedic or a PA or anyone else out there, RNs, nurse practitioners, whatever may be the case, and realize that we all have stuff to offer. And so when Tyler mentioned this and he was looking for feedback, I thought this was a great way to open up this dialogue and talk about a very different side of emergency medicine. Because again, paramedics are going to have to manage the vents in certain cases before they ever get to us. Or as you even talked about in the one scenario, was that what about transferring a patient from one ED to another ED, where the first ED, the you know, physicians having a hard time managing it. And it may end up being that the paramedic may have something that they may have up their sleeve, a little trick to get that situation better off. Now, there's a lot you were talking about in that piece, and you mentioned about changing inspiratory and expiratory flow rates and stuff like that. So I'd like to talk just briefly about the kind of two main patterns of ventilatory management. Do you mind touching that real quick?
Chip, before I answer that, I just want to go back to something you said, because I think it is so important that it resonates. Why should a physician or a PA trust a paramedic to adjust or initiate ventilator settings? And then why are paramedics even messing around with the ventilator to begin with, trying to come up with some new concoction of strategy? The answer is if the ventilator settings make sense for the patient and their ABGs have been taken into consideration, their ideal body weight has been taken into consideration, the plateaus aren't exceeding 30, then we probably won't, if it makes sense. The only time we're really interfering is if we are not getting good ventilation, oxygenation, the peak inspiratory pressures, the plateau pressures are dangerously high, then we will have to make some adjustments. Now, some of these adjustments or these alarms are not something that's going to be audible. A plateau pressure above 30 is not something that's always going to set off an alarm on the ventilator. If you're not checking it, you might not even know it's there. And it's so important because of some of the ARDS studies that we see in ARDSnet shows that ventilator-associated injuries are very high, and you increase the likelihood when those plateau pressures exceed 30. So there's a lot of things we're looking at here, and we're not just going in and messing around, arbitrarily turning knobs just to do so. So as long as the critical care transport service has extensive and exclusive training in ventilator management, then there really shouldn't be an issue there. Now, in a very simplified approach, you can separate ventilator strategies into either one or two different modalities. The first one is going to be the injury patient. And essentially, anyone who is not an obstructive patient is an injury patient. How do we ventilate them? We use lower tidal volume, 6 to 8 cc's per kilo, keep our P-plats below 30. We recruit with inspiratory maneuvers. We maintain with PEEP. And usually that works pretty well. Now, the opposite side of that is the obstructive patient. And these are the patients that need a longer time exhaling. Now, I categorize the obstructive patient into two subcategories. And that's either going to be the patient with a loss of parenchymal elasticity, emphysema, or the patient with a decrease in airway caliber, which is asthma. And I did a podcast called Flavors of Obstruction that really goes into detail on these two different methods. Now, the patient with asthma, very little literature supporting the use of non-invasive positive pressure, very little evidence to support the use of PEEP, because PEEP is not going to stent open the bronchioles. That just isn't going to happen. You're just going to make it harder for them to exhale, and the effects could be deleterious on the patient. Now, the loss of parenchymal elasticity, there is a tissue called elastin in the terminal ends of the bronchioles, and that goes to shit when somebody gets emphysema. So it's basically like blowing into a paper bag. You have no elasticity, no recoil to get that air back out, as opposed to blowing into a balloon. So when that happens, we have to meet that with PEEP. And when I say meet that, I mean meet their auto PEEP. So you're going to have to check what their auto PEEP is. And then you're going to have to, generally what I recommend is trying to keep your extrinsic PEEP below 75% of that. Now, there is a lot of heterogeneous views when it comes to how to utilize PEEP with the obstructive patient. What has been your clinical gestalt usually? What do you do, Chip?
That's a really good question. It's a little bit complex, and I'll start with kind of a story of something that happened to me recently. A lot of people who manage patients on a ventilator, it seems like when you don't have a lot of experience with it, you stick with one strategy for every patient. You know, it doesn't matter what they came in for, pneumonia, they came in for COPD exacerbation, whatever the hell it is, it's going to be the same strategy. And the problem is when you get to patients like this, because I had a patient not too long ago who was a crashing asthmatic patient. And this was a shit show of a situation. Things were going downhill quickly. And this was a kid that needed the tube quickly as possible. Let's get this done. And so what I did was I got the tube in, got everything going. Just like I said, RT's not used to this kind of situation, so I made sure to specify what I want. I usually start out on ZEEP, zero peep, and the main reason why is because of the concern for auto peeping, right? So we want to try and avoid that if we can. Now, next thing I know, our hospitalist comes in and decides that he wants peep because he's used to that ventilatory strategy. Put peep on someone, you put five of peep, so on. And he wasn't very happy with his results, so he kept going up and up and up and up. And next thing you know, we have air trapping with auto peep, and the patient starts going downhill some. Well, I already had warned RT, and so kind of it's like one of those, as soon as the hospitalist leaves the room, take the peep back off again. Now, your situation's different because what you're trying to do, and you did such a great analogy, I'm going to steal it for a second. The difference is with these types of patients, especially when you're talking about the disease to last in, so they've lost the ability to recoil. And so instead of blowing into a balloon, that air is no longer going in like a balloon where it's going to blow up and it's going to recoil nicely. The whole reason why you need that peep is to keep it open, because instead it's like a plastic bag. So the big plastic grocery bags, they're going to blow up okay, but they're not going to retract back down. So you need some peep. So for me, if it's someone who's going to be like your situation, I'm okay with them getting peep if we understand that the goal is this person's going to need very close monitoring, especially initially, right? Because this air trapping phenomenon can happen very quickly. It can happen very slowly or it can happen very quickly. Usually isn't this slow on gradual onset that happens a little bit later, but it's usually going to be one of the two. They're going to either go into this quickly or it's going to take a while for them and you have to just kind of stick around. But the big thing is, if you're going to start messing with peep on obstructive patients, from my experience at least, albeit somewhat limited, is you need to be careful about just how much peep you're using and be quick to dial it down or to adjust. So for me, I'm going to be very closely monitoring how they're doing on their pressures, and are they showing any signs of air trapping phenomenon besides what I want them to have. I know there's going to be some of that's going to be built in and what I'm going to desire for them to get full oxygenation, but I don't want them to start crashing on me because next thing I know, I have obstructive pathology going on.
You know, Chip, it's funny because I was just talking to Eric Bauer from FlightBridge Ed about this exact topic, and he sent me a really good article that was in the Cleveland Clinic Journal of Medicine on how much external peep to apply and why. And the article said the seeming paradox of why applying external peep does not make auto peep worse has been explained by an analogy of a waterfall. In this analogy, the upstream part of the stream is like the distal airways, the downstream part of the stream is like the proximal airways, and the waterfall is like the site of critical airway closure. Pressure in the airway is like hydrostatic pressure in the stream. Now, you know, just pretend that the tide comes in, and, you know, you're applying external peep and you raise the height of the stream below the waterfall. This has no effect on either the flow or the pressure upstream of the waterfall unless the water level rises above the level of the waterfall. And that would be like your peep exceeding their auto peep. So generally, if you're keeping them below that 75% mark, you're holding the doors open to the airway, but you're not contributing to the auto peep. And I think a really good tool is if you're increasing your peep and your peak inspiratory pressure is increasing, then you're probably making the auto peep worse.
Now, one other thing to throw in here real quick, speaking of kind of analogies and stuff that was mentioned, this is something I want to make sure gets into this podcast because it was mentioned in yours. And again, if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't listened to Tyler's yet, go back over, listen to Tyler's. Again, it's in the show notes. Just do that because it makes a lot more sense for this. But when you've got this patient, and let's say this is going to be, for example, in my setting, if this patient's probably this sick, we're going to end up transferring them. In most cases, in most of the shops I've been in, we're going to transfer this patient just simply because it's a pretty complex case and it's something that there's probably a lot more going on there and they need a tertiary care center for that. But you finally got a desired amount of PEEP. Whatever you do, don't just let that all go. Clamp the damn tube and you can transfer that over onto the new vent. Don't just take it off because, oh, we'll bag them for a little bit until we get the vent set up or whatever. You've lost all the pressure that you've built up, and this is not a quick process. This is something that takes time, and next thing you know, you could potentially lead to another hypoxic event, and we already know that patients who've gone through hypoxia, it's not good for them. There's really bad outcomes with that, and think about repeat hypoxic events. You're going to set yourself up for failure, so clamp the tube for a second on inspiratory, not expiratory, because there's that too. I can see that being screwed up by someone. So inspiratory is the goal there. And again, this is going to sound really weird because classically you're thinking, well, this is arguing with Scott. And I don't think it's arguing with Scott. I bet if you talk to Scott Weingart about this, he'd say the same thing. Now, to keep a very basic argument with the ZEEP, you know, I understand why he did that in his original podcast, because that's a complex subject. That would take up the entire, well, hell, it's taken up more time for us to talk about obstructive pathology than it did in his. We're just talking about one piece of it. So for me, I would rather think this through, but be very, very cautious with the patients. And that's why when I heard Tyler talk about this, I wanted to make sure that we had this conversation about how important it is to pay attention to your PEEP in this. You did a fantastic point on the less than 75%. I think this is a nice, clean way to think of it. But for me, with patients, I get just a little nervous on it. But if you're there watching it, and if you got it to work, if you've done exactly what you need it to do, which is exactly what PEEP is there for, right? PEEP is supposed to help keep it open to create the oxygenation flow, what you need. Don't lose it because you decide to switch it over. And this doesn't happen a lot when the person stays in the ICU because they're going to be on the same vent most of the time or whatever. Keep in mind, though, if your patient does start crash, and I'm talking about truly crashing patient, you're going to go through your dope mnemonic. The first thing you're going to do is take them off the ventilator, right? That's a different scenario than what we're talking about. We want to keep that PEEP there so it's a more natural transition for our definitive care, however we're going to do that. So that, again, that's not meant to go against the dope mnemonic or anything like that. We're purposely wanting that air in there for that strategy to work.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things is people take patients off the ventilator way too easy. And they go, oh, we got to take them off. I'm getting alarms. The patient didn't get better on a BVM. The BVM just doesn't have an alarm. And I think that's so important to realize that generally you did not make the situation better. Now, obviously, there can be air trapping and hemodynamic response to that, and they're drop their blood pressures down the shitter, blah, blah, blah. But generally, if you take the patient off and you're bagging them, and if you listen to me and Eric Bauer go back and forth on this, we have a strong passion for not using the adult BVM that's capable of delivering well above the recommended tidal volumes. You're not really fixing them by bagging them.
So I know you're getting a little bit tight on time here, but I have a very important question that I think ties into this. Now, in your strategy, your proposed strategy, what you're thinking of, you talk about a respiratory rate between 12 and 15, kind of that crash setting. And again, it makes sense because you need this long inspiratory, and I'm going to call it long because 2 seconds is a long time initially. Like you said, you don't stay there, but you've got this long inspiratory and expiratory time. Now, that means that they need to have very few breaths because, again, we want them to blow off their CO2, right? That's a big part of the strategy, and oxygenation. We need to get both corrected at the same time, which can be a real difficult thing to do. A lot of patients, when we sedate them, we're not fully sedating them. We're letting them breathe some over the vent. And that happens a lot because there's a desired effect there. But with what you're, and I don't want to put any words in your mouth, so correct me if I'm wrong here, but what you're describing, if I do this with most of my obstructive patients and most of my lung injury type patients, so either way, they're probably going to start breathing over the vent. Do you, in these situations, believe that they need to be knocked all the way down to a point where they're not spontaneously breathing, that's truly the vent that's doing its job? Or are you still letting them breathe over it?
Great question, Chip. I think this is something that a lot of people wonder. The patient already proved that they weren't doing a good job breathing for themselves. Usually if they get to this point, they have exhausted themselves enough that they weren't ventilating. If they were ventilating appropriately, then we probably wouldn't have intubated them. We probably just would have gone to non-invasive. Now, if you go to the point to where you actually intubate them, usually they don't have much of a respiratory drive. They're not trying to exceed the ventilator. But if they are, I like to take an A1 approach, which is the analgesics first, because we know that that is going to help depress their respiratory drive a little bit. Do everything you can to not paralyze this patient. And I think that if you can make them comfortable, fentanyl goes a long way with this.
That is a huge point. Thank you for mentioning that. And for my people who are listening out there, who've listened to all this stuff, especially the students out there, you know how much I hate people just getting paralyzed without proper sedation. This is different, what we're talking about. What we're talking about here is part of a larger strategy. And I'm sure that when you're doing this, because looking at your old stuff, you're a very big proponent on proper sedation with this and pain control. So it's not like you're just throwing the rocuronium at it and calling it good.
Yeah, so I did a podcast called The Agitated Intubated Patient. And I talk about this because paralytics should be like one of the last things that you consider. So I talk about all of the things that will play into a patient breathing asynchronously, trying to rip the tube out. Obviously, I like to go with the A1 approach, analgesics first. So I like to take care of that pain with fentanyl. If they're still trying to pull the tube out, obviously, I've got a sedative on. So ketamine is nice because it takes care of both of those right off the bat because we have analgesic properties and it's a dissociative anesthetic. And then I start looking for weird things, like is there Foley clogged? Because you would be surprised how hard it is to sedate somebody with a full bladder. It is extremely difficult. And I start looking at these weird little things like that. I check their blood sugar. And then I look at my ventilator settings as well. I want to make sure that my inspiratory flow rate is adequate for the patient. Inspiratory flow rate equals comfort, especially if you listen into Scott Weingart's Dominating the Vent. He talks about that. And I think that that holds true. That's absolutely correct. You do want to optimize that. Usually, if you can get it around 60 to 80 liters per minute, patients are happy. And the way you increase that is just by decreasing your inspiratory time. And that just inversely increases the inspiratory flow rate. So I'll check that. So I want to check all of this stuff. And if they're still breathing asynchronous from the vent and they're breath stacking, you know, at this point, I'm going to have to say, all right, I sedated them. I have pain medication on. I've made sure they're not hypoxic at this point. I made sure the tube is in the right spot. I got good waveform. And I have to do something because if every breath they take is going to contribute to that air trapping. And at that point, I might pull the trigger on paralytics.
Great responses to everything. And again, I appreciate having you on. I know we didn't get to talk about quite everything. We may have to add this just as we go along with some other future podcasts here. But do you have any other final thoughts?
Chip, thanks so much for having me on the show, man. It was a blast. And I plan on having you on the Lifestar podcast here pretty soon.
Yeah, no problem. I'd be happy to do it. So without further ado, do you mind giving us the tagline?
Absolutely, man. It'd be my honor. This is Tyler Cristofoli from the Lifestar podcast saying, continue to provide total care everywhere.
Thank you for downloading another episode of Total EM. We want to thank our bandwidth sponsor, FunnyRx, for sponsoring this show. You can also see them on our website, but we also have included links to their website, funnyrx.com. Again, thank you, FunnyRx, for sponsoring this episode.